meeting of Parliament, Wednesday, 29th of March, 2017. I have received notice from the Chief Minister that he intends to move now the suspension of standing orders in order to make two government statements this morning, and I suppose inform members that he will do the same this afternoon in order to make an additional assert statement this afternoon. The Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move on the Standing Order 73 to suspend Standing Order 71 in order to proceed with a government statement.
I now put the question that the Standing Order should be suspended as moved by the Honourable Chief Minister. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried. The Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the terrorist attack last week in London was a strike on the mother of all parliaments. It was an attack on British democracy, and as such, it was also an attack on this Parliament. We take our powers from an ordering council that originates at Westminster. We are part of the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, which is based at Westminster. And of course, Mr. Speaker, we are British. And any attack on Britain is therefore also an attack on us. In this instance in particular, Mr. Speaker, and to tell honourable members that along with the Deputy Chief Minister and the Attorney General, I was in exactly the area of the attack the very day before. We've been in the Lords and in the Commons lobbying for Gibraltar, meeting friends of Gibraltar, and engaging with members of both Houses of Parliament in support of Gibraltar's cause. And on our television screens, we saw many regular visitors and friends of Gibraltar affected by this attack. Mr. Speaker, it is the Westminster Parliament that represents the modern concept of the rule of law. It is that Parliament which has, for longer than any other, been the embodiment of freedom and respect. And we in this Parliament will want to stand shoulder to shoulder with our parliamentary colleagues at Westminster in the Commons and the Lords. We express our solidarity with all MPs and all those who work in the Parliament in London. In particular, we express our condolences to all those who lost loved ones in this attack. Four innocent dead in the heart of Whitehall is an atrocious tally of evil that all in this House will want to roundly condemn. Specific mention must be made of the loss of life of police officer P.C.Q. Palmer. On days like last Wednesday, we are reminded that we are indebted to all police officers for the dangerous and often thankless work that they do to keep us safe. The death of a police officer in these circumstances serves only to emphasize the risk that they take every day. It is also worth noting the heroic efforts to revive P.C. Palmer, a former Gibraltar ADC, Tobias Elwood, now a minister in the Foreign Office, and he has now been elevated to the Privy Council.
The Honourable Chief Minister speaks on behalf of the opposition in what he has said to this House in his statement a few minutes ago. All that I would do on behalf of Her Majesty's opposition is to offer our condolences to the families of the victims and also all those that were injured. In particular, the four individuals that unfortunately, tragically lost their lives in this terrorist attack: Isa Braid, a mother of two; Kurt Cochran, a US tourist; Leslie Rhodes from South London, and of course, as the Honourable Chief Minister pointed out, Police Constable Keith Palmer. All of them, Mr. Speaker, left their homes and their families that morning, expecting to return to their homes and their families later on that day, and unfortunately did not do so. And on behalf of Her Majesty's opposition, I wish to extend my condolences to the families of the victims.
Mr. Speaker, every year on the 5th of November, the United Kingdom comes together to essentially celebrate a failed terrorist attempt to destroy the House of Lords. This atrocity that wasn't has become a part of folklore, but it draws attention to the fact that even over 400 years ago, the heart of British democracy was already a target for those who wanted to subvert the values that the building represents. Last week, the edifice came under attack again, and while the methods may be different, the times more modern, and the building itself changed, the intentions were still the same: to threaten our freedoms and our political structures, and to inspire fear into the hearts of the world's citizens. And while Guy Fawkes and his co-conspirators were defeated, so was this latest perpetrator, showing that these values are as robust and as deep-rooted as the buildings that protect them. In this case, unfortunately, there were some fatalities, and we, as a house that also protects the democracy it represents, must pay tribute to their memory. These victims themselves characterize the kind of modern pluralism that extremist actions fail to undermine. A female British teacher of Spanish origin, a male American tourist, an elderly Englishman who incredibly used to wash the windows of that very bastion of democracy himself, Winston Churchill, and of course, an unarmed police officer who was tragically killed while discharging his duty. As unnecessary and cruel as these deaths are, Mr. Speaker, they are nonetheless a reminder to us all of the value and dignity of a life bereft of hatred, violence, and evil. I express my deepest and sincerest condolences to the families of these individuals, with the assurance that their memories will never fade in our appreciation of the freedoms we enjoy. For this is a time of heroes, Mr. Speaker, of heroes like P.C. Keith Palmer guarding the front line of these freedoms, of heroes like MP Tobias Elwood selflessly helping wounded despite that the uncertainty of the event's immediate aftermath, of heroes like all those policemen who stand outside high-profile targets and promise us that our lives will not be disrupted, and of heroes like the security and emergency services that protect our communities and keep us safe. And while the pain we all feel will eventually fade, history will remember these heroes and the sacrifices they have made in the name of everything we hold dear. But there is perhaps no bigger hero than the City of London itself. This glorious metropolis has weathered many storms, but wounded and cornered, it has refused to be beaten. It has risen from the ashes of the Blitz. It has risen from the rubble of Bishopsgate. It has risen from the mangled steel of the July bombings. And every time it has risen, it has defied hatred as a diverse and cosmopolitan city of dreams that will not fall to violence, but instead will stand up for the democratic values that we represent. The very morning after the attack, Parliament convened in that same building, showing that the wheels of democracy were far from having been derailed. People took to the streets to reclaim their own freedoms and show that the city's heart was still beating, that democracy cannot and will not be defeated, and that we will not give in to the fear of hatred. London and its people should be commended for this response, for sending a clear, unified message to those that aim to divide. But this response, Mr. Speaker, must be a responsible one. The world cannot afford for these actions to create tensions between its people. This event and the person behind it must be rightly condemned, but we must not blame race or religion or immigration or revile an entire culture because of the actions of one. Violence and hate cannot be allowed to divide people and to make us cast doubts and suspicions over others. To do so would be to threaten the values that many have died protecting, and the unity of our condemnation must be matched by the unity in our humanity. These are the actions of one deranged and evil individual, a man resentful of our freedom, representing nothing but a violent anger that has no place in any spirituality. And it is precisely by being united and by remaining loyal to our common humanity that this futile menace will be defeated. This has been an awful episode in human history, Mr. Speaker, but I am confident that these stories of heroism and the stoic refusal to give in to fear will once again show us for the remarkably lucid and compassionate species we are. Thank you.
And the Honourable Member wish to associate in further discussion? I will now ask the House to I would now call on the House to observe a minute silence in honour of the City of London and the Members of Parliament. Mr. Speaker, all members of the House will have been saddened to hear the death of Mr. Morris Schwerer. Mr. Schwerer sat on benches on both sides of this month. As a leading light in the integrationist movement of the late 60s, Morris became a member of the House of Assembly as a government minister, was the Bob Felicia as Chief Minister from 1969 to 1972, and the Peter Isola as his fellow minister. Those were challenging times, Mr. Speaker. The front of the closed and logistical arrangements akin to a Berlin area had to be put in place. After the election of 1972, Mr. Schwerer remained in this house as a member of opposition, with Sir Joshua re-elected as Chief Minister. In that year, of course, Mr. Speaker, both he and Mr. Bassano were elected with Mr. Schwerer as members of this house. Interestingly, Mr. Speaker, I know that today in this house, there are two people who sat with Mr. Schwerer in this place, and two people who stood with Mr. Schwerer in election to this place. You and Mr. Bassano sat here with him between 1972 and 1979, and Mr. Bassano and Mr. Peeton stood with him in 1972 and 2003, respectively. I do know, Mr. Speaker, that in the gallery, you see a former member of this House, Mr. Caruana, who also sat here with Mr. Schwerer. Mr. Speaker, the 10 years in which Morris was a member of this House were, as ever for Gibraltar, challenging and difficult. The closure of the frontier by dictator General Franco was perhaps the most difficult moment. But no less difficult was the return of democracy to Spain and the UK's attempts to engage us in some of the discussions of Spain as a result. For much of that time, Morris was in the heart of the action as a member of this House and as a minister or opposition member or leader of the opposition. A very full biography of Mr. Schwerer cannot be given today, but it is worth noting that he was a member of this House for decades and that he was known for his eloquence while here. I will always remember a phrase he coined in the 2003 general election, the first one I and the leader of the opposition were candidates in. Morris's turn of phrase then was to say that the election was not about grooming horses. I could see how he'd managed to encapsulate contesting theories about what that election could be about in just one phrase. He will have been pleased that neither of the two colts in that election had done badly. I considered Morris to be a friend of the Speaker, who could argue a totally contrary political position, but he was nonetheless happy to have dinner and share anecdotes and tales of political battles fought in a convivial and jovial spirit. Last week, on hearing of his unexpected death, I spoke to his son David to express the condolences of the government and of the people of Gibraltar. Today, I recall the thanks of this House for Morris's work in it and his contribution to it. Mr. Speaker, the angry young man is with us no more. But his powerful words in debate, his anger at injustice, his passion for Gibraltar, and his contribution to the House will live forever in the record of proceedings of this place.
The Honourable Leader of the Opposition. Mr. Speaker, much has been said about Morris Schwerer, the politician, and he was indeed one of the great political figures of his time.
a founder member of the IWBP, a member of the Constitutional Conference that negotiated for Gibraltar the 1969 Constitution, which linked him the preamble to the Constitution. He was de facto Deputy Chief Minister in the IWBP government of the early 1970s, and then leader of the opposition with the IWBP and then the Democratic Party for British Gibraltar. There is absolutely no doubt that he was, together with Sir Joshua Hassan, Sir Bob Felisa, and the Honourable Member opposite, the Father of the House, one of four political figures that dominated the politics in the 1970s. To this day, his result at the 1976 election, where he stood as an independent following the collapse of the IWBP, coming second in the overall result, continues to be the best result by an independent. Indeed, no independent since has in fact succeeded in being elected to this House. It was a great shame, it has to be said, that despite the fact that he was honoured by this Parliament with the Gibraltar Medallion of Honour, he was not, alas, honoured by Her Majesty. I do not understand the reason why, Mr. Speaker. Perhaps it was that he left Gibraltar for the United Kingdom in 1979, at a time when I am told the DPPG were ahead in the polls in order to follow his wife and his two young children. Anyone who has served in politics at the level that Morris served will understand the unique pressures that politics places on family life. His wife Shirley was raised in Jamaica, unused to living in a small place like Gibraltar, relying on a very small parliamentary salary, and with those unique pressures, the strain must have been extremely difficult indeed. When Shirley left Gibraltar, he followed, but unfortunately, their relationship did not endure and they separated after a few years. I know that having left Gibraltar in these circumstances left very deep emotional scars. And years later, he would tell me that for many years, he felt as if he had turned his back on his country. It was one of the reasons why he stood with me in the 2003 election. He wanted, with a lean, to exercise that growth that had haunted him for many years, and he did so by standing again, even though he knew he had little prospect of getting elected. I am glad he did, Mr. Speaker, because he became like a father to me, like a mentor, and he followed, and I indeed followed him. We traveled together in my own political journey since 2003. He was a man of enormous understanding, honesty, integrity, and humility. He was described in the 1970s by his political opponents, and I quote, as an angry young man. I never knew him as a young man, but I never saw him lose his temper. He was firm when he had to. He would get on his high horse when he felt a matter of principle was at stake, and would never compromise on what he felt was fundamental. But I never saw him lose his temper. If I was to pick a gripe with him, it was that his powerful intellect often led him into writing opinion pieces which I described to him, and he agreed, as being the length of a new thesis. He just had to cover, Mr. Speaker, every single point he felt was important from every conceivable angle. Even after he left frontline politics, he would often send me his opinion pieces for a second opinion, always with the title of the email, quote, please slap away, end quote. It is, of course, his unwavering commitment to retaining British sovereignty over Gibraltar that he is best remembered, a commitment that earned him the nickname at the Foreign Office of the Abominable No Man. He was deeply suspicious of the Foreign Office, but also, Mr. Speaker, it has to be said, of any nationalist tendency in Gibraltar.
He will of course be committed to the concept of maintaining our current levels of autonomy while strengthening our link with the United Kingdom. In the form, it is like a year of devolved integration, something that he and I both believe might become increasingly relevant in this new chapter that Gibraltar travels in, a post of Brexit. A few years ago, Mr. Speaker, his beloved Marianne passed away, unfortunately, because of cancer. She had been his partner for many, many years, and I knew that he was deeply affected by her loss. I know that he is now in a better place, and Morris, my friend, my mentor, until we meet again, may you rest in peace.
The Honourable Mr. Rosella. Mr. Speaker, I have little contact with Morris after he left Gibraltar, and therefore, with the Honourable Leader of the Commission has told us about his subsequent life is something that I think many of us are not familiar with to the level of knowledge that he has told us today. But of course, I came into politics because of a position that was created in 1964 when the United Nations Committee of 24 for the first time was addressed by Sir Joshua and Peter Isola and came out with a decision which stands today as it stood in 1964 and is the basis of the annual battle we have to fight in the United Nations. And it was because at that time the position that was being taken was that Gibraltar wanted close association, something that did not exist in the terminology of the UN. There were only three options there. There was an option of integration which we were not familiar with, but which in fact was brought to the light of day by a journalist who was also working in BBC, Hector Licouri, who was the first one to raise the issue of that option as an alternative. And we set up a group to investigate the possibility. We got in touch with the Maltese, to whom it had been in fact offered, and Mintoff eventually rejected it. And from that initial investigation, we created the pro-integration movement, which was a precursor to the IWP. The pro-integration movement was the first contact I had with Morris, other than the fact that we shared years together in the government. And in that first contact, it was when we first started gathering some momentum for the conflict. And indeed, it was no more than an NGO. It was, we had, within the AACI, we had supporters of integration. And there was a debate, which was not a partisan debate. We were looking at the merits of the alternatives that were before us in a situation where what was available under the UN Charter, which is not so-called close association, but free association, had a serious weakness from our perspective at the time, which was the fact that the relationship could be ended unilaterally by the UK. And therefore, a free association decolonization mode would have allowed the United Kingdom, given the atmosphere that there was then and continued with even greater force after the death of Franco, that a deal had to be the UK resisted the United Nations call for talks to Spain until Franco died. And that is at the time that I was in opposition and Morris was in opposition, and it was at the time that the talks started with Marcelino Oreja in Strasbourg. And those talks were the talks that were being held under pressure from the United Kingdom in order to comply with the UN recommendation, because it is not a binding thing, recommendation that the process of decolonization should have to be one in which the Spain would be involved, and as far as Spain was concerned, their involvement was only to agree the terms of the recovery of the Balkans. In that context, the position that Gibraltar found itself in following the referendum was a position that was extremely difficult because the decision was getting worse by the day. And it was a baptism of fire for somebody like Morrison and Joe and other people who came in for the first time into government, straight into government without being in a position before having an opportunity to learn the ropes of the game, and having faced a situation where overnight our workforce is disappearing. I mean, you know, the one thing that people fear, which I think we're all confident is not going to happen, is a repeat of that situation. If today the workforce that we have in Spain could not come in, the effect on our economy would be even greater than it was in 1968, because at that time, many of those workers were here to keep the military base going. But today, it is not the military base that is going, but the private sector, which is a big role in all the money that we authorize to be spent in this house through the taxation of that way. And we need to understand just how important it is that we keep the private sector going. But in those days, when Morris came in, the important was that the military base, which was 70% of our economy, and the public services were the big users of foreign labor, and that foreign labor had to be sold. And the deal was done with the Moroccan government, used to be the offices of the British government to bring people here. And Morris, as Minister for Labor, was faced with a situation that nobody had ever had to face in that job before. And it was on the basis of that that we were enabled to keep an economy that was flourishing because of the level of activity of the military bases kept up. Within the confines of what could be done in 4 years, I think the transformation that was carried out in Gibraltar by the first IWDP government, which came in under very difficult circumstances and not only managed to maintain the momentum of the economy, but in fact did more, admittedly, some of it was UK development aid because of the aid program under the sustain and support policy that the UK put in place the moment that we had the threat of being stranded by our neighbors. But nevertheless, it produced enormous results, and there was the government was able to rally everybody around in a situation where people were prepared to work voluntarily. I remember the police are going to work in the Alameda Gardens to give an example to the rest of doing work free of charge because of areas that were short of labor. I think that Morris's contribution in a technical sense, in terms of being able to deliver things with his ability, was a very important part of the success of the government. And I believe that for him it must have been very difficult to leave Gibraltar and leave his involvement in politics. I mean, I was the one who invited him to join the integration movement before he became a political party. And there were other people in that original movement from all walks of life, and it was a completely non-partisan. It became a political issue when there were two political parties, each one with a different philosophy. The philosophy was, what is best for the culture? Look, I think in this house, and in our community, it is very important that we limit our differences to legitimate things in which we believe we are advocating what is best for the voter, and we don't allow it to deteriorate into something that becomes then a personal issue between us, and we then follow a course of action which is driven no longer by putting the interests of our country and our people first. I don't think that ever happened with Morris. I think Morris believed in every time, with everything he said, that he was doing what was best for Gibraltar, even though some of us might have disagreed with some of his later statements after he left Gibraltar and came back. And certainly, we were very close friends, we were very close colleagues, and I joined the statement that had been made by the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition at the Great Loss of the Volta crisis. You know, some of us are nearer that point in life than others. I hope it will be a long time before speeches are going to be made by me about doing this house.
The Honourable.
Mr. Speaker, my family name's connection with the late Maurice Rivera is one that goes back many years, even to a time before either you or the present father of the house were involved in local politics, difficult as it may be to imagine such a time. He was a contemporary of my father's, and as such played an important part in helping Gibraltar take those tottering steps towards being a more functional and self-sufficient democracy. Mr. Tivadas' contribution as a member of this early generation of Gibraltar's political development are significant, and include his participation in the Constitutional Conference that led to our previous and historic constitution, serving as a minister in the RWDP government and later as leader of the opposition, a role that saw him represent the voters' interests in discussions with the United Kingdom and Spain, as well as accompanying my father to Strasbourg for these important meetings. Mr. Civera played these roles with full conviction to his principles and values, and there was never any doubting of his commitment to what he felt was the best for Gibraltar. Of course, Mr. Speaker, history naturally shows that Mr. Civera was also a political rival of my father's, but despite this, the Gibraltar always held his adversary in high regard. They disagreed on many matters of local and international concern, disagreements which have continued well beyond my father's sad passing, but as has tended to be the case in local politics, there was a healthy mutual respect in this relationship between Chief Minister and Leader of the Opposition. Indeed, Mr. Civera wrote my father a very kind letter shortly before his move to the UK, where he expressed both his admiration and his appreciation for the way in which the Gibraltar had always treated him. And while the particular versions of history may have differed, I can confidently assert that my father and his family have always remained similarly appreciative of how Mr. Civera served the people of Gibraltar. It is unfortunate that Mr. Civera's direct involvement in local politics was cut short with his passing, for I am convinced that he would have continued to make important contributions to our evolving democracy. It is obvious that his interest in local development continued even to recent months, and his engagement is still today helping to shape the minds of some. As a member of the latest generation of the genealogy of parliamentarians that both my father and Mr. Civera started almost 50 years ago, I would like to give thanks for his loyal service to the nation we have all been elected to represent, and of course, would like to extend my condolences and that of my family to all of Mr. Civera's loved ones. May he rest in peace in the knowledge that Gibraltar is a better place today because of what he did yesterday. Thank you.
I'd like to echo those sentiments myself. I'm not going to deal with the politics of the situation. My relationship, my close friendship with Maurice was also based on other pillars. We spent 6 wonderful years teaching together in the grammar school. During that time, we were both also involved with the Teachers Association, campaigning for the recognition of teachers, which we didn't enjoy then and which they enjoy now. And another aspect of our close friendship was the fact that for a decade we used to go out to bat opening the innings for grammarians, who were both very keen cricketers, something that also strengthens our friendship. Politics never divided us. We could write about that, something that I would commend for. It's terribly important that we should all realize that there are much more important matters in life that bind us together than political differences. I join myself, my staff as well, with the sentiments that have been expressed. It was a terrible shock. Only last January, Morris was sitting pretty well where Joe Capuano is now. It was the last time we saw him in the house.
In light of those tributes across the floor and from the chair, I would now invite the House to observe a minute's silence and a mark of respect for the passing of Mr. Morris, the former member.
I think the best way to honour the Reverend Cavallo is to most of those memories of questions, arguments, and debate in this house.
We'll now proceed to answers to all questions, and we commence with question number 229. The questioner is the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, does government have any plans to construct park and ride car parks to the north of the runway as per the 2011 manifesto pledge, and then rent all spaces in the Devil's Tower Road car park to residents?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, as part of our government's 2011 manifesto commitment to provide parking north of the runway, the right to service of Gibraltar announced on the 16th of January 2014 the use of Western Beach car park. The right to service of Gibraltar also invited tenders in 2014 for the commercial development of the old air terminal site. One of the tender requirements was that any proposals include an element of parking for cars and motorbikes for public use. In view of the public plan and its potential options for the car park at Devil's Tower Road, no final decision has been taken on the use of this car park.
Question number 230, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, of the 456 parking spaces sold at the Midtown car park, can the government say how many different owners there are and, if there are any instances of multiple space ownership, provide a breakdown of the number of spaces purchased by a single owner, given the number of spaces owned by each owner?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, the executive question is attached in the schedule handed to Honourable Members.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not sure that we will be able to answer this question, but I'll ask it anyway. I note on the list that there is a single owner with 8 parking spaces and another single owner with 10 parking spaces. Is the Minister aware of whether that is a private individual or a company that owns those spaces?
Peter, yes, we are both companies.
Question number 231, the Honourable T.N. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister say what progress has been made with the introduction of black cabs with environmentally friendly engines?
I answer the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, the London Taxi Company, as you see, are currently in the process of inaugurating their new facilities in Coventry, UK, where the new electric CX5 black cab will be manufactured. The left-hand drive version will not be available until early 2018, with LTT focusing their initial build on the right-hand drive version, which is their core market. We expect to be able to procure this version of the traditional London taxi. The left-hand drive new 6 version of the outgoing CX4 version was not manufactured by LTC due to resource deployment totally being allocated with the operation of the new facility and the development of the right-hand drive new CX5.
Thank you, Minister, for that response. I just think that the suggestion that there will be a procurement. Is it government's intention to actually procure the black cabs themselves, or will they be procured privately?
Mr. Speaker, we have had with the procurement partnership with the EPA.
Can the Minister describe how that partnership takes place? So, what do you mean in partnership with the DPA and the government going to be providing funds for them?
Mr. Speaker, we haven't completed any discussions on this with the DPA, so it's still when the black cabs are available, we will then sit down and discuss details. We think this has not been done before, is because the black cabs, as I said in my initial reply, have been impossible to procure. Not that we did not want to procure, in fact, we are very keen on seeing black cabs within the water, and we have reflecting that existence of the water. But unfortunately, they were not available, and because this has now been going ahead to probably 2018, late 2018, when the discussion really has not and finalise what it said.
But clearly, Mr. Speaker, if the plan is to enter, it was to have a partnership with the DPA, and bearing in mind this was, this concept was introduced back in the 2011 manifesto, and 2018 is not so very far away now, when it certainly was the case in 2011. There must have been some conversations already with the DPA, some agreements in principle as to how this partnership would work.
Mr. Speaker, we work with a DPA committee whose life is much closer than ours, is within Parliament, and our committee's changed, opinions change. So, what perhaps we'll discuss very briefly with one committee, has evolved with the election of other committees. So, it is not until we see these cars becoming available, which is what we are. Which is what we are waiting for now, and then we will then sit with the committee of the day to discuss the final details and how we proceed from there on.
Mr. Speaker, presumably an initial costing exercise at some point was undertaken in order to come up with this manifesto commitment. Does the Minister have any idea of how much a single black cab of this nature would cost?
Because we have no idea what the new electric cabs will cost. And the initial calculations or investigation was made with the CX4. And we don't know what the new electric cabs will cost in the future.
And could the Minister of the calculation have begun for the previous version of the cabs to have a figure approximately of what one of those cabs will cost?
Something I remember last year is not relevant whatsoever. I mean, the question's asking, you know, what we try to do with the price of business were then. I mean, it's totally different to what the price of the electricity will be in the future. So, I mean, until we do not have a final price for the electricity, it would be, you know, calculated in the past and it's totally different than today. Whether the intention with the partnership with the DCA, whether to provide black cabs to replace all taxis with black cabs, or just a proportion of them. Or we can also go to and find out what the cost of the black cab is, the purchase, and we can do the math ourselves, and that's how many cabs we think would be involved. Okay, initially, what we're looking at is just the cabs in cabling that's promoted to public with private hire vehicles, which belong to the DPA. So that is the only thing that we're being looked at. So, they would be, I would say, at the point of the time, I think there are six vehicles which are run by the DPA themselves. So that would be the initial part of this one.
Question number 232, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Over to question 196 of 2016. Has the government had an opportunity to review the recommendations made in its Environmental Action and Management Plan on no idling signs? And does the government intend to begin a programme of placement of these signs? And if so, where?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
The government is reviewing the recommendations on no idling signs as part of a holistic review of the EANP. The intention is to ensure that recommendations relating to traffic and traffic reduction reflect and complement the measures included in the Sustainable Traffic Transport and Parking Plan, which is to be published shortly. Additionally, many vehicles now feature no idling facilities built in.
Mr. Speaker, just bear in mind, originally, the Environmental Action Management Plan, the placement of the Horizon Sands actually had a time frame associated with it. I believe it's probably 15 years since we collected on that. Is the Minister now saying that actually it may be the case that the decision will be taken on review, that recommendation will be rejected and that no Horizon Sands will be placed? What is the purpose of reviewing a recommendation which appeared within the plan, so has already been accepted by the government?
The Environmental Action Management Plan is under constant review, and it's acutely being reviewed at the moment. A lot of the commitments in the plan have been achieved. Others, we have to review the time frame for it. I don't think that reviewing something actively could be taken as a negative, and I suspect that when we get the review completed and we have new, remember that these time frames are aimed, they're not, and you do it in advance, and you're not absolutely certain that you would be able to hit them. But certainly the intention is to complete all these requirements, and it is very likely that the no idling signs will still be a feature of the plan.
To make this intervention. Could I just ask, because representations have been made, and whether the government would consider at least accelerating the process for the places of no idling signs, particularly at the frontier, where it's an obvious place where there is still for no idling signs to be placed, and also in areas of the upper route where often vehicles are in queues, and similarly, pollution can become a problem for pedestrians.
I don't have the plan in front of me. I think it specifically did refer to the frontier, and that is one clear area where where this is an objective, and there are other areas as well. But I think really what we have to do is convince people that hydrogen is bad, and that the environment bad for one's health. So probably more than just finding a specific area, we need to encourage it in other ways as well. I think the upper rock is one area where possibly, in some specific cases, these could be used. But I think the front is probably the worst offender.
Question number 233, the Honourable Ian Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can government describe the operation of the new speed cameras, and in particular, whether the image they capture is of the front, back, or both aspects of the vehicle?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, I'll ask you a question together with question 234.
Question number 234, the Honourable Ian Hammond.
Can government say if speed cameras will be in operation at all the designated sites all of the time?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, my current devotees in the process of connecting speed cameras at various locations throughout Gibraltar. These locations are Bedestar Road, Rosie Road, and Europa Advanced Road, where 40 speed camera positions are available. This pilot project will see cameras placed in all these locations, becoming active and will be controlled operationally by the Royal Gibraltar Police. Depending on the success of this initiative, that is aimed at reducing mortality and injuries from speed-related accidents, further locations will be considered, maybe improved in the future. As with parking fines, which have recently been increased, the government has no desire to specifically money for speeding or illegal parking. What we all want to see, and I'm sure I speak for all members of this House, is that people should not offend in that way, save lives. Make our roads safer and ensure citizens follow the law of the road. These are manifestly not measures designed to raise revenue, as success of the measures will be when the revenue decreases.
Mr. Speaker, absolutely. I'm sure everyone in this House supports any initiative which will enhance road safety. I've not brought the revenue raising into the equation, so I'm not sure why the Ministry pains to point that it's never a revenue raising initiative. But I would ask him whether he could answer the question as to what aspects of the vehicles the cameras will photograph. It would be the first question asked, whether it be front, back, or front and back.
The reason why I mentioned the latter part in the question is because there were critics who suggested suggesting the government would raise revenue with the cameras. That is not the point of the cameras, as I said in my reply. As people realize that cameras are functioning and are quarter cameras, they will then obviously reduce their speed another quarter, and that will reduce revenue, and that will be the end of it. As to the direct question the honourable member is asking, this is something which I don't think is in the interest of actually mentioning the details. This is something which the Royal Police, is managing, is the official police, member is adamant to be normal, and have to discuss this in the annual speaker's chair if necessary.
Mr. Speaker, I really can't understand why it's not in the public interest simply to know whether the speed cameras will be taking images for the front, the back, or from both aspects of the vehicle. I would thoroughly recommend personally that speed cameras have the capability to capture images of both aspects of the vehicle. That way, all vehicles, whether they be motorbikes or cars, can be subject to the same restrictions on speed and the same rules, and fined accordingly. It would seem inappropriate only to have the capability from the front, because then clearly it would be very difficult to find motorbikes for speeding, and certainly one of the more dangerous aspects of driving on our roads, and the people most vulnerable perhaps are speeding motorbikes. Riders, and often it's very young people who are new to the road who tend to fall into this trap, and alas, and tragically we have seen accidents over the years occurring with young people. So I would probably recommend to the minister that he ensures that the capability of the cameras is such that people can be discouraged from speeding on motorbikes, and clearly there is some value to having a front aspect of the vehicle, because it then allows the driver of the vehicle to be identified as well. Of course, a vehicle can be insured for multiple drivers, so it would be very difficult to find an individual if only the vehicle is being photographed from behind, for the very simple reason that it would be very difficult to identify who the driver is. I just would ask the Minister for his views on that.
Mr. Speaker, we brought to Parliament the bill to deal with cameras, and the member will remember, and so will remember, that regardless of who is driving the vehicle, the owner will be on the registered owner if he can be proved otherwise. And that was something that was discussed in Parliament, and we found that we approved unanimously in that respect. So we hope that the other members should be saying and should be mentioning that.
Speaker, I thank the Honourable Minister for coming on the public interest point to assist the Honourable Gentleman in the House. The cameras are complex and they deal with a number of different aspects of vehicles in different places. So what we're saying to the Honourable Gentleman is we're happy to have a discussion with him, but we don't want to provide a guide as to how the effect of the cameras may be avoided by people, and hence why we have a debate across the floor of the House. We're inviting him to have the information that he's speaking behind the speaker's chair. I thought that reasonable when they say we're giving the information, we just don't think it would make sense to be sharing across the floor of the House that level of information. The police may take a different view as to how to deal with issues related to deterrence, and they will be the ones on the front line of deciding what is said in terms of any campaign about how the cameras operate, etc. And we feel that we should not be the ones putting that information out there at this moment in that way, and we're happy to have a discussion with him. In terms of consideration, all the things we've said are the things that the government considered at the time that we're procuring the cameras, so we can't for a moment think that we didn't take all of those issues into consideration in the context of procuring and installation and now at the central operation of the cameras.
Question number 235, the Honourable Ian Quinty.
Speaker, further to question 101 in 2017, can the government advise if it has now made a decision in respect of the one expression of interest received to the V7 vehicle fleet, and if so, what are the financial terms agreed?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, the answer remains as set out to question 101 of 2017.
Speaker, I'm grateful to the Minister of Malta. Can you give an indication to the House as to when you might expect to make a decision?
Mr. Speaker, we will in the moment of the year, we know when, or we know when it's in the decision, we will not let the annual member know when that happens.
I say to the Honourable Member who has asked the question, it is exactly the same question as he asked for the last meeting, with the addition of the word now. The answer he has received is the same. I therefore will not allow him to ask another question on the leasing of the government's fiscal seat until 6 months have elapsed.
Mr. Speaker, regarding the guidance of any other, we have already discussed this unit. I would however ask for some flexibility, if I may ask the question about vehicle leasing in a different context.
This could be a development in the interim period. If there is a development from the government, if they were to announce the award of the tender, then I will allow the Honourable Member to ask about the financial terms of it. I think that only if that happens. Question 236, the Honourable D.A. Seaton.
Mr. Speaker, having supply workers are currently working within the Post Office and associated services, and since when have those individuals been on supply?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Commerce.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, there are 11 supply workers currently working in the Post Office, most of whom have been on supply since August of 2015.
Mr. Speaker, does the Honourable Gentleman have a breakdown of when those individuals started as supply workers? And I'm interested in particular, any individuals that have been on permanent supply, continuously on supply for a considerable period of time. That's really what I'm focusing on at most of my saying, so to the Honourable Minister, the question I asked.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the issue of permanent, the residual and permanent supply, there is some of that called more than others do. And the way that the formula works is depending on how many days you've been called over a period of time when you get to an allotment of days, that is when you are eligible to be considered for being permanent. So it isn't that I have the details of how many continuous days each of the suppliers are given a supply for, because I don't have that information. But I can tell you that. The start dates are, as I said, 6 from 2015, the majority from 2015, 1 from 2014, 2 from 2013, 1 from 2009, and 1 from 2007.
Mr. Speaker, the information that I have is that the mailman has been on permanent supply, in other words, working continuously, and bear in mind, Mr. Speaker, that when an individual is on permanent supply, they don't have the benefit of holiday leave and also sick leave. But permanent supply for 4 years, the US fulfillment individual has been on permanent supply for 3 years, partial post continuous supply for 2 years, and the an individual in the registration room has also been on permanent supply for another 2 years. Can you confirm those figures?
No, Speaker, I can't confirm those figures because I don't have that data available to me. What I can tell the whole member is that I am meeting with the supply workers, in fact, tomorrow. The meeting is set at around about the same time that people have received the notes that I received, and we'll be discussing these things with them at our meeting.
And does the Honourable Gentleman agree with me that for somebody to be 4 years on permanent supply is really extremely unfair on that individual and on that individual's family? Bear in mind, Mr. Speaker, that when they were in opposition and we were in government, we were constantly lambasted for there being individuals on permanent supply. And indeed, it was a manifesto commitment of ours in 2011. And I do recall that the Honourable the Father of the House also went to the Post Office during the course of the 2011 election and told individuals there that all those that were on permanent supply would be made permanent.
I think one of the issues that we have is that we don't really understand what the Honourable Member means by permanent supply, because what I understand is that people that are on supply could be on supply for a year and get called once a week, twice a week, 2 days a week. To what extent that is or isn't permanent supply, I don't know. From the information I see in this part, I can tell you that none of the people that he's referring to have worked every day on supply for the period that they have. Not from the information that I have. But as I said to the Honourable Member, we will be meeting, the supply workers to work with the issues that you have on the paper that I have, and hopefully make some progress to see how these matters can be progressed in order to ensure that the taxpayer receives value for money in their personal service.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm very grateful for that. I can tell the Honourable Gentleman that the information that I have comes straight from the horse's of mouth, and these individuals have been working continuously, the first individual for 4 years.
it appears, Mr. Speaker, that at the heart of the problem, but of course the Honourable Minister will make his own mind up when he talks to these individuals, is that there are a number of vacancies that exist at the post office, and indeed there have been individuals that have been moved out of the post office into other areas. But for example, the postal stalker retired in 2013, for example, that's a post that's not been filled. Now, does the government have any plans in relation to these particular posts that are vacant at the post office? Or indeed, does the government have any plans for, in respect of the individuals that have been moved out of the postal workers, therefore creating this space within the postal service that needs to be occupied, in my view, that's my assessment, by these individuals on permanent supply?
Mr. Speaker, with respect to the length of permanent or normal supply, I will wait to meet the horse to understand what it is that they're telling you. But in respect of what the vacancies are, what the operational aspects are, I think what we are currently doing is doing a review to better understand exactly what the position is. And once that has been completed, I'll be in a much better position to discuss with the people employed and, of course, the union, how we see things moving forward.
We now move to question 276, the Honourable Alex Young.
Mr. Speaker, further to written question 24 of 2017, is the government now able to provide an answer?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, this is the exact same question as question 24 of 2017. And accordingly, the answer remains the same.
Mr. Speaker, is the Minister able to disclose whether any questions have been carried out or is currently being carried out?
Mr. Speaker, assessments are being carried out, yes.
And I cannot allow the Honourable Member to raise this sample program in that system.
Question number 277, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise with whom the responsibility rests for the collection of housing arrears in future in respect of the 6,000 estate mortgage, and how will this be managed?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, the collection, the responsibility for the collection of rent arrears will continue to be that of the Housing Department and Ministry of Finance.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Minister for answer. If I may ask, can you confirm that in terms of the entering into arrears agreement, that the government will still be pursuing the same policy as it has done in the past, and offer exactly the same terms and conditions that have offered in the past to tenants of the 6,000 estate prior to the mortgaging?
Mr. Speaker, yes, in relation to the 6 estates that are subject to the financing, the same conditions apply because the first thing, Mr. Speaker, is that we have to collect arrears of rent regardless. While, of course, we have a duty in the estate, we also have a duty to the taxpayer in the other estates as well. So we continue to pursue them, to collect them, to trace them as vigorously in relation to all the debtors in the same way.
Mr. Speaker, if I may ask the Minister, what would happen in the event of a significant build-up of arrears in future? Wouldn't it be that the government will have to make good any deficit in rent collected and have to be paid over to the collective limited? Or does that risk in the respect of the rules why the devolved debt lapses limited are not receiving rent, or does that risk rest with the Minister of Housing, in which case does he have an obligation to make good any difference in the collection of rent from people?
Mr. Speaker, that of course is a hypothetical question, which is not allowed under some laws. In any event, Mr. Speaker, for a question of that detail, I would need notice of the question. However, Mr. Speaker, what I would say in a general answer to that is that if the collection, and to allay Mr. Clinton's fears, generally, in relation to arrears generally, is that since the arrears collection agreement commenced last January, so it's been going on for over a year, the trend has been that arrears have been decreasing and decreasing significantly every single month of the year, except for the month after Christmas, where we had very little increase. But other than that, and they're now down to a level below the month before. But the trend is that the figures are going down and nothing.
I'm very thankful to the Minister for the answer and assurance that the rules will be going down. May I ask, is there, I presume there is, a mention of form, is there actually an agreement with the Board of Capital Assets in respect of the collection of rent? And would you be willing to provide that to the House? Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman is asking questions he knows the answer to because he was briefed privately on the subject of this matter. That is not a question that arises from this question. It is a question of which he should have given specific notice, and he would have got the answer he was specifically briefed outside of this House because we said that we would consider those arrangements with him and with other members of the House. The Honourable Lady attended the meeting after which he was briefed in respect of those matters.
Question number 278, the Honourable Aaron Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, Forbes question 173 of 2017. Can the government advise of methods of sentencing sent to young people to start the process of purchasing new affordable homes above the legal needs and have found that sentencing is healthy?
Aaron, to the Honourable Minister for Housing and Quality.
Mr. Speaker, not yet, but it is expected to happen in days. We want to ensure as far as possible that the letters go out to all persons interested.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Minister for answering. Can you give the House an indication of how many letters will be sent out to human charity statistics, and if possible, maybe a big ask, a split between both developments?
Mr. Speaker, I would require notice for details in relation to that question.
Mr. Speaker, I will of course in the future table a more detailed question. But could you give us the House a ballpark figure for how many letters he intends to send out? You must have some idea. Mr. Speaker, there's a lot going on in Gibraltar, and a lot going on in the world for us to be here being asked to give ballpark figures and numbers of letters. Mr. Speaker, if he wants to know how many letters are going to go out, he asks us how many letters are going to go out. If he wants to know how many letters have gone out, he can ask us once they've gone out, how many letters have gone out. If we give a ballpark figure and it's somehow slightly different to the figure we finally give, letters have gone out, then we face the question of why we gave a ballpark figure that is different to the figure of actual numbers. This is not a question that arises from have they gone out. I mean,
Why does the Honourable Gentleman think that it is appropriate to ask a supplementary about detail? And if it's detailed, give the Minister notice of the question, and then we'll happily come and tell you how many letters we are preparing to go out. It's not something we're giving information. It's a question of being asked a question about detail in the context today of a question in the question which doesn't arise.
Mr. Speaker, I'm ready for the Chief Minister's intervention. Just for sake of clarity, the question I asked was specifically in respect to the letters, and I assumed that we would know, the Minister of Energy would know how many were being prepared. But I will not pursue the point any further. I will do as the Chief Minister suggests, and I'm putting a more detailed question. I appreciate this and that question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker, for that very only government non-question. But the other government is more reasonable to change. I mean, there will be more people in the housing waiting list, and we want to pass the net as widely as possible. So it's not something that we can know today. We can go and we still number when it happens, and we'll be quite happy to go in. It's just a question of counting the pieces of paper that have gone out to different businesses.
Mr. Speaker, if I may intervene, I noticed that the statistics in online have disappeared on the housing site. Is there any reason for this? Mr. Speaker, I'm not sure how this arises as a supplementary question, but I will answer because it was a question put to me by the Honourable Mr. Reyes last night. Were explained that we've noticed some errors in the information that was going up, and we were completely reviewing everything that was online because it was more important for me to make sure that if information is available online, that it's correct and it's accurate. Things that we discovered when we reviewed, which for some reason were being inputted by different people and not being inputted properly. So that was a parliament question of last month's parliament, when we put it up.
We move to question 288, the Honourable Ms. M.B. Hassan.
How many government dwellings are there currently in Gibraltar which are vacant or derelict?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, we are currently undertaking an in-depth study of all the properties. Because if I may ask, does government or the housing ministry have any policy or any intentions to allow for the Gibraltarians to take any of these derelict properties on and perhaps beautify them and take them over in the future? Because yes, in the future and in the past, because that's precisely what we have been doing with these properties. What we are doing at the moment, though, is looking at all the properties that we have available in our property portfolio to see how collectively we can move forward in a way that best suits the needs of the government and indeed, as one of the laws say, the needs of the housing needs of people in the world.
Mr. Speaker, just one question arising from that question. If the government is conducting, as the Minister says, an in-depth study into various properties, surely they must know how many dwellings are vacant or derelict.
Mr. Speaker, again, it's a number that fluctuates, and it's not for the Department to determine whether the property is derelict or not. We need to consider various things into account. I mean, to look to see whether a property is vacant and beyond economical repair, in which case it would then assess it to be derelict. There have been assessments which we are reviewing, but it's all the reason that I haven't provided the figure is because it is a subject to change, subject to this review that we're conducting, because it will all be taken into the global context of the properties that we have. But we will have a very clear picture in the not too distant future because we've done in this study. It's something that we're looking at collectively, because we're looking at the pastures of properties that we have available. And it may be that it entails moving properties, so it may be that we have more empty properties in the future, but with a view to looking at after having urban renewal and urban regeneration of certain parts of local town in particular.
Question number 289, the Honourable Aaron Kenton.
Mr. Speaker, currently government please provide the total gross tax aggregate debt-off application and sinking fund to gross debt, tax reserve and net debt figure for public debt as at 1st of February 2017.
Honour to the Honourable Minister for Economic Development, Telecommunications and the GST.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 290 to 301.
Question number 219, the Honourable Aaron Kenton.
Mr. Speaker, I beg your indulgence if I leave my voice in the next 5 minutes. Mr. Speaker, can the government please advise in taking liquid reserves figure and its constituents, namely consolidated funds, improvement development funds, government-owned companies, deposits, contingencies, and other funds, for the following dates from the 1st of February 2017?
Question number 291, the
Honourable Aaron Kenton. So, Mr. Speaker, can the government please advise how total liquid reserves are invested held, given details of all bank savings, bank accounts, and cash flows for the following dates from the 1st of February 2017.
Question number 292, the Honourable Aaron Kenton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise if the divorce savings bank has invited any expressions of interest for all or part of its shareholding in the telephone?
Question 293, the Honourable Aaron Kenton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise if it is confirmed that inflation for the quarter ended 1st of January 2017 is 2.5% compared to 1.5% in the previous quarter, and you still committed to pay increases of 2.75% or inflation, whichever is higher, for the public sector?
Question number 294, the Honourable Aaron Kenton.
Mr. Speaker, given that the Chief Minister in his 2016 budget address, or budget speech, stated that the government would have a 49% interest in Shell LNG Gibraltar Limited, can the government advise why it answered question 87 of 2017 as follows, and I quote, there are no other joint ventures other than the one mentioned in the question?
Question 295, the Honourable Aaron Kenton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise what are the financial terms and periods for new savings products offered to holders of Gibraltar Savings Bank debentures that mature in 2017?
Question number 296, the Honourable Aaron Kenton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise why was Strand Credit Finance Company Limited, number 08489759, allowed to be struck off and devolved by the UK Register of Companies by compulsory strike off on the 4th of December 2015, and was on its property consequently bona vacantia?
Question 297, the Honourable Aaron Kenton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise why it was not necessary to incorporate a new Strand Credit Finance Company number 10094514 on the 31st of March 2016 in the United Kingdom, and how much did that cost?
Question number 298, the Honourable Aaron Kenton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise how it intends to manage the net £275 million raised by way of mortgaging the six housing estates and who is the responsible officer?
Question 299, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please identify which government-owned company is to make payments to the Baltic Capital Assets Limited by way of closing allowance, and what contractual arrangements have been put in place to facilitate this?
Question number 300, the Honourable Ian Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise how much has been paid in rent collected to Gibraltar Capital Assets Limited from the section of the new tenancy agreement for 6,000 estates to the 31st of January 2017?
Question number 301, the Honourable Ian Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise the balance on the general sinking fund as at the 1st of February 2017?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Economic Development, Telecommunications and the GST.
Mr. Speaker, the position of the public debt as of the 1st of February 2017 continues to be as previously stated, except that the cash reserves were 95.6 million and the net public debt was 357 million. The position of regards to total liquid assets composition, when, where, and how these are invested on a particular date, chosen by the minister opposite, by the member opposite, continues to be as previously stated. The GSB has not invited any expression of interest for the shares in the telecom. The January level of the IRP is in line with what I predicted was likely to happen when I answered the Honourable Member's questions in relation to the index increase of last October. All the indications are that inflation is likely to be higher in the future than it has been in the recent past. The question on whether we stand by our commitment, the answer is we do stand by our commitment. I answered question 87 to 2017 by providing the information requested in the question. There are no new savings products being offered to holders of the DSB debentures that mature in 2017. I am informed that Strand Credit Finance Company Limited was cut off having been dormant due to an oversight on the part of the UK administration to meet the cost of reincorporating it. The cost raised by Gibraltar Capital Assets will be managed by the Treasury as part of the pooled cash reserve of the government company, and the housing allowance payment will be received by the company from the funds in the pool. The rental income for the previous requested was £1,896,189.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Minister's response. As usual, I will just take a couple of minutes to absorb it. I don't have an answer to 301, the balance in the general sinking fund.
Mr. Speaker, the answer to that is already contained in the answer that I've given you.
But then, Mr. Speaker, I asked specifically for the balance on the general sinking fund. I don't recall hearing that number.
Well, Mr. Speaker, if I tell him that there has been no change, and as he knows what the balance was before, then the answer is that the balance is what it was before. If we should be able to work that one out for himself.
Mr. Speaker, I know you've been a great fan of the time scripted process, but could the Minister involve me in giving me the number of the balance as at the 1st of February?
No, Mr. Speaker, I don't know why I should involve him. I spent every month telling him that there has been no change, and now he can't remember what was the figure that I gave him. Well, let me call it up.
Mr. Speaker, coming to the question of the Star Island and Gibraltar Limited, can the Minister advise the House whether he considers this to be a government joint venture, yes or no?
I don't tell him what questions he should put, and he doesn't tell me what answers I should give. No, I give him the benefit of my experience, for which is always grateful, so that if he proves his performance, which he seems to be doing, because he's not been promoted, but we are not holding a reputation. I think he should thank me for that. Well, if the Honourable is asking me to express an opinion, then, in my opinion, if the GSL, the savings bank, also is not a joint venture, you know, it's coming for the third party.
Sorry, Mr. Speaker, I don't know if the Minister and myself are talking about top questions, but if I'm just hearing him say, because the savings bank owns all the shares, I was talking about the RMD, the Star RMD.
The answer that I gave him was in relation to the question that he asked. Right? And he asked whether there was a joint venture with shares by a government company, and the answer is that there isn't. The fact that the statement was made at a certain stage in time, saying this was going to happen, doesn't mean that things can't be changed and plans cannot be changed. There isn't a government company in joint venture.
Mr. Speaker, the reason why I asked this question is because, and I will put a question to the Minister in a minute, is because I'm conscious of the Minister's desire for precise questions, and even precise answers, which I know is better. But in this, in raising questions in the House, I have to clear my own head, my mind, as to will that question elicit the answer that I'm expecting or not. And if the rules of the game change, it's very hard for me to ask the right question to elicit the right answer. It's a bit like playing animal, vegetable, and mineral, but suddenly the vegetable becomes a mineral, the mineral becomes a vegetable, and I don't know which is which. Mr. Speaker, I'm just a bit concerned as to whether the Minister has been given the correct information. Because we do a search on taxpayer ONG, you will find that it was incorporated not long after the Chief Minister's speech on the 18th of August 2016. And of the 2,000 different shares, Credit Finance Limited is a proud owner of 98 shares, which is essentially 45% we were talking about. Now, Credit Finance is being still owned by the Gibraltar Government Corporation. Now, when I start asking about government joint ventures, is it that the Gibraltar Government Corporation under their own is not considered a joint venture, or is he, in his answer, just only going to answer in relation to specifically directly owned government entities and nothing that's related to GBC. I'm sure the Minister will appreciate the difficulty that causes this in asking the right question. I'd be grateful if the Minister could clarify.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the question I want to clarify to the Honourable Member is that if you keep asking questions here on information that he has already obtained, which is publicly available, which is something he's not supposed to be doing. The Credit Finance Company is predominantly owned by the Gibraltar Savings Bank, and it is therefore something that is used as an investment vehicle by investing in activities or products or ventures that will promote the economic development of Gibraltar, and therefore the Credit Finance is invested because it comes within the terms of reference of what the savings bank does under the amendment which I introduced in the House in which he voted in favor of. But it is not the government with government money.
Mr. Speaker, I know I risk weighing in to extending the question. Don't we need to write that the credit finance, the 30 million ordinary shares are owned by the Water Development Corporation, and that the preference shares are owned by the savings bank have no voting rights? I don't know what I said, because as far as I'm concerned, the majority shareholder in the company is the Gibraltar Savings Bank. Otherwise, if the honorable member's analysis is true, then it would mean that all the things that he has said about the credit finance, which has been criticized by him and by his colleagues on innumerable occasions, on the basis of the credit finance where the company was being used to give money to the government, all that would be false if in fact the payment belonged to the government. Because how could the government be given money to itself and be criticized for doing it? Because there is an element of the original ordinary capital that was created under the GDP, and then the bulk of the capital is provided by credit finance. So if credit finance provides 400 million out of 430 million, I don't think you only remember of the argument that it is owned by the owner of the 30 million and not by the owner of the 400 million. So I don't agree with his analysis, and it certainly doesn't stand against his previous intervention when he has been critical, and so have the leader of the opposition, and they've accused the government of using credit finance as a source of finance for government projects. Well, look, if it belonged to the government, as the honorable member is now trying to describe it, then all the previous arguments will belong to it, because then the government will be using something that belongs to it.
Mr. Speaker, I only find the minister's logic infallible. Following his own logic, and following what he, I believe he just said, what he is telling the House is that if the savings bank owns the 49% indirectly through credit finance in Star Energy, under the terms of its amended object in which the terms of economic development is voted, would that be correct?
And if you learn a very handsome return on that investment.
Mr. Speaker, is it not the case that the position is as follows, that what we have is a government-owned company that is being funded to the tune of £30 million by the taxpayer through the GDC and £400 million through savers money through the Water Savings Bank. But the vehicle itself is owned by the government. It's a government-owned company, at least partly owned by the government, even though as my honourable friend has said, only shares are owned by the government through the GDC, the second shares are owned by the Water Savings Bank.
The member is asking me to be true that the government, the Gibraltar Development Corporation owns 30 million of the shares, and the credit finance company owns 400 million, then of course it is true, because I have just said so myself a few minutes ago, and I always tell the truth. In any event, it's a matter of public knowledge. It's not a secret. But of course, if the honorable member would be happier if the 30 million that is owned by government was also owned by credit finance, I will take that on board and see if I can make him happy.
Is it not also the case that the circularity of the argument is as follows? I mean, you have a government-owned company, credit finance. It's owned by the government because the government owns the ordinary shares. It's also partly owned by the Gibraltar Savings Bank. But it's funded by the taxpayer and by the Gibraltar Savings Bank. The 400 million in credit finance, which the Gibraltar Savings Bank has invested,
have gone to another government-owned company, which is Gibraltar Investment Holdings Limited. It is then being used in order to pay for expenditure that Gibraltar Investment Holdings Limited has, including the funding of all the other Gibraltar government-owned companies, which includes projects that those companies, the expenditure that those companies may have on behalf of the government.
Now, well, that arises from the question on the LNG shell company, but of course, over the honourable member is saying it's of course that I am right in my analysis, and I am grateful to him for saying that, because he's saying that in fact the company that is providing the finance is a government company, and therefore if it is a government company, then it cannot be arguing that a different entity is providing money to the government. Logically, his argument would only be consistent with what he has said in the past if he accepts that the government is a very small minority shareholder, that is to say, it's a shareholder that has 30 million out of 430 million. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the logic is that the decisions on the investment are determined predominantly for the benefit of the owner of the 400 million, which is the Gibraltar Savings Bank, which is why I'm answering this question.
Final question, Mr. Speaker. The point is that you can have a government owned company that is capitalized, that is provided with capital, with money, by the Gibraltar Savings Bank. It doesn't alter the nature of the beast, of the vehicle. The vehicle is a government-owned company, at least partly so. It may be funded by the Gibraltar Savings Bank, but it's a government-owned company, and it's then a government-owned company that makes the decision, be it on behalf of the shareholders or whatever, but it's a government-owned company that is making the decision as to where the money is being invested. It's actually being invested in other government-owned companies, and those other government-owned companies are using it in order to fund projects that the honourable gentleman promised about the 50 people at the last election, and well, indeed, previously in the 2011 election.
Think of credit finance, invest money that it has obtained by issuing shares. It invests the money in order to make a profit so that the debenture holders are able to get the return that they do. There is no way that the honourable member's opposite can be in favour of the savings bank having debentures and paying the rate that they do, and again, the savings bank deploying those funds in accordance with the power that it has to do under the law to make a profit. I mean, I don't know if it is that the honourable member prefers that the profit should go to a bank that is not owned by the government, and that when capital has to be raised, it should be raised from other banks, which is something they used to do when they were in government, when they used to put money in Barclays Bank and then borrow money from Barclays Bank, except that when they lend it to Barclays Bank, they were getting 1%, and when they borrowed it, it was 36. But look, if and when the members form the government debacle, they can stop credit finance, they can reduce the activity of the savings bank, they can go back to having reserves of £1,444.45 instead of 25 million, and that is their prerogative. But they have to get a vote to do that. We've got a vote to enable us to do what we're doing. And all that we're here to do is to explain to him how it is being done, which he doesn't have to agree with.
And I'm very grateful for him, to him, always for his candid explanation, certainly that I have found when that explanation I always find very helpful. But drilling down to where the differences are here, which are highlighted and actually come out of that answer, is of course. If you are taking debentures, or the Gibraltar Savings Bank, I mean, is taking money from customers, it got to offer a rate, and from 2011 to 2013, it was offering rates that went up to about 5%. That was well over market rate. There isn't an investment, unless one is talking about riskier investments. It's very difficult to actually have safe investments that will offer, it's impossible, more than 5%. Indeed, banks, UK Treasury gilts, they were all offering less than 1% for most of that period. What is happening here, and likely the Honourable Gentleman to confirm it, is that credit finance, the money from people to savings bank into credit finance, is actually being invested in the government of Gibraltar. That is the way it is being invested. And therefore, it is the government of Gibraltar, because it's those government-owned companies that are owned, that's where the money is actually going. It's Gibraltar Investment Holding, the government-owned company, and all the other government-owned companies that are benefiting from this money, and therefore the government, that's the investment. It's the government ultimately that's going to have to repay this. And that is why we've always said, well, actually, it's the government indirectly through this complicated vehicle that is actually borrowing the money, even though, technically speaking, it's off the book of the government. But, you know, apart from the sunburn, I have to say that I can't think of, on my feet, any private investment, or significant private investment, into which the 400 million has actually been paid, other than to government-owned companies for government profit.
The question is about the investment in the LNG plant, which has been made by Credit Finance. And he says he can't think of anything around the sun. But well, look, the question that we have by Mr. Clinton, Mr. Speaker, is about the LNG investment. The LNG investment is by Credit Finance. On a return, the joint venture is a joint venture between Credit Finance and Shell, not between the government and Shell. Now, the issue is whether a company which is owned with 400 million out of 430 by the savings bank and 30 by the Gibraltar Development Corporation is a government company. That is what the issue is. As far as I'm concerned, it is not a government company because the government is a minority. But if they would be more comfortable if it was 100% owned by the savings bank, then I'd prefer to make them happier by spending 30 million and buying the 30 million shares, and maybe they don't have to worry anymore.
Mr. Speaker, I need to wrap up on this particular question and then move on to other ones. In terms of this particular investment by Credit Finance and Shell LNG, Prime Minister, if I understood him correctly, he was telling the House that the Shell LNG Gibraltar plant is not a government joint venture project. Is that correct?
A joint venture between the government of Gibraltar using a government company, but it is a joint venture between Shell and Credit Finance, which has got a minority shareholding of the government. That's what I'm telling you.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Speaker. And again, just wrapping up on this, can the Minister advise, in terms of Credit Finance, whether you'd be willing to provide information in terms of the equity investment that Credit Finance does?
By the equity investment, he wants to know if the number of shares that there are, then the number of shares that there are, he knows already from the registry that he says he's got to look at.
I'm not referring specifically to Shell LNG, I'm talking in general of any other equity investments that Credit Finance may have.
You have the answer to that question before, but I don't understand.
I would like the minister to refresh my memory in terms of which question specifically I asked that.
I don't remember the answer was no.
Mr. Speaker, again, I beg your indulgence in this policy question to get to it. There is a question 292, where the minister advised the House that he was not invited any expression of interest to the holding of the telephone. Can I ask the minister, does he undertake an annual valuation exercise of the shares that the savings bank holds in the telecom in terms of potential earnings multiples, etc.?
No, Mr. Speaker, we carry the shares that are not quoted. You will remember that we asked me a long time ago about whether shares were quoted or not quoted, and I told him that they were not quoted because the agent is not on a stock exchange. Even though there was a reference recording in the paperwork that I supplied him with. The value at which we purchased it, probably if we were to do an evaluation based on the return which we are getting, which is an 8% return, you know, the capital would be worth more. But that's not the way we do it. You know. If we were at some stage to dispose of the shares, then clearly the remaining shares would be revalued at whatever money was paid for the ones that we sold, because that would be logical.
Let me see question 293 in terms of inflation and the public sector pay increases. Does the minister have a view as to inflation and how far it may or may not go up again? I will defer the inflation by the personal question. I'm sure you have some feel for where the number may be. And if in terms of the public sector payments, do we have a cost for honouring that commitment at say the 2.75% level certainly for this year in terms of overall the cost of the inflation increases?
In the estimate, we always include a figure from which I think something like 9 million, which is, you know, well above what is required for the pay. But that has always been the case. And it is from that figure that there is a provision that is then distributed along the heads of expenditure when pay settlements are made. And that means the cost of the pay, which is an important part of that 9 million, and increases either for other charges that may come in at a higher figure than expected. I mean, you know, inflation will be something that will affect the government budget, not just in respect of salaries, but in respect of procurement. The answer is that the figure, I can't tell you what the figure is going to be this year's budget, because we haven't just done the budget, and it would be wrong to preempt those figures with you. We will be able to see at the end of April, but it's unlikely to be less than what we provided in the past, because you know, if we look at inflation before the period where prices were, I think, deliberately being kept down, and interest rates were being deliberately and then by this policy of quantitative easing, which put a lot of money in the market, you know, something like 2.5 to 3% was considered to be a normal rate of inflation. Indeed, a lot of governments have been trying to get the level of inflation to go up to the 2% target of the Bank of England, because they consider that in order to stimulate economic growth, there has to be an element of inflation in the economy, and when, you know, when the inflation has been at zero, or in some cases below zero, negative, when prices have been falling, then that is considered to be a recession if it happens in two consecutive quarters, you know, according to the mantra that most economists are tied to, but I don't necessarily. question is, I think we need to think of inflation around the 3% figure as normality, because all we need to do is to go back some 3 years, and we will find that, you know, for example, in the years before 2012, it was 3.7, in 2011 it was 3.5, in 2010 it was 3.4. So, you know, those are the recent figures until this very strange period that we've lived in the last 2 years, which has been artificially engineered.
Mr. Speaker, we have to move the House to now recess until 3:30 this afternoon, when the supplementary session professor will be over speaking.
House announces to 3:30 this afternoon.